I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today I'm going to discuss some of the more important medical and nutritional stories of the day. I often interview guests here on Health Talk, or sometimes I have a conversation with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, but today I'm going to go solo because I have so much to talk about. There's an enormous amount of information that I need to share with you. It's backlogged, so I'm going to attempt to share with you some of the more vital stories of the day. And one of the reasons I've got so many stories is because a peculiar thing happened to me at the office. It's been a busy summer, and so I scarcely noticed when I stopped receiving my monthly copies of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which is the most important nutrition journal in the world. Finally, I inquired. I said, you know, what's happened to my subscription? And they said, oh, yes, there's been a mistake. You do have a subscription, and we're going to send you all the back issues that we didn't send you. So all of a sudden, a big box arrived in my office, and it was May, June, July, August, and September editions of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So I've got a vast amount of material to share with you. I'm not even going to attempt to share all the articles at once, but during the next few broadcasts, we'll try and work them in. Just so much happening. So I'm going to start with an article that is entitled, Saturated Fatty Acids Do Not Impair Endothelial Function and Arterial Stiffness. And that's a very, very important article because let's cut through the jargon here. Often it is said that the culprit, the number one culprit, actually there are two in the American diet in terms of heart disease, are cholesterol and saturated fats. And so they tell us to go on a low cholesterol diet, and they also tell us to reduce our saturated fat intake to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. However, several studies, and I've been sharing these studies with you as they've come out, and some people just find it counterintuitive or astonishing that this is the case. Studies show that the consumption of saturated fats, if you actually do a study and you quantitate the amount of saturated fats that a population consumes, that there is zero correlation, no correlation whatsoever in terms of cardiovascular disease. And they've also done not just individual studies, but studies of studies called meta-analyses, where they group together all the best studies, and they could find absolutely no difference no matter how much saturated fat or cholesterol you consumed. So all this stuff that they've been telling us over the years, eat a low-fat diet, avoid especially saturated fats from meats and cheeses. They've even done individual studies on dairy products, finding that people who consume high-fat dairy are actually okay. So this article, however, looks at something different. It looks at what's called endothelial function. It also looks at arterial stiffness. You know the expression hardening of the arteries? Well, that's what we in the West get as we age, and we tend to attribute it to fats that glom onto our arterial walls, like sticky junk, like super glue, that tend to form like deposits of glop and that are hard to dislodge. And then we get heart attacks and strokes. I mean, it kind of makes sense because I guess if you throw a lot of lard down your toilet, you may get a clogged toilet pipe. But in a human body, it does not appear to be the case. And this article examines that particular contention. And let's see this article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. The study looked at individuals who are insulin resistant. So already they were prone to cardiovascular disease. Insulin resistance is the major driver of risk of cardiovascular disease. And oh, by the way, most of that comes from exposure to excess sugar and refined carbohydrates. So they actually measured vascular function first after consumption of a high saturated fat diet for a month, and then after diets that were either very low in saturated fats, less than 10%, and or were high in monounsaturated fats or carbohydrates. And what they found was, you know, they tell people to replace saturated fats with monounsaturated fats, like olive oil, follow the Mediterranean diet, and oh, make sure you have a lot of whole grains, get a lot of carbohydrates. That seems to be, yeah, mainstream dietary advice these days. And here's what they found. They found that replacement of saturated fatty acids with monounsaturated fatty acids, you might read olive oil in this case, or carbohydrates, did not, I repeat, did not affect vascular function. In other words, the ability of the arteries to stretch and adapt to changes in blood pressure. And while this was a short-term study, what they could see, based on the study, is that saturated fats from things like palm oil or high-fat dairy or meat fats didn't cause the arteries to literally cringe and constrict, close down, clamp down, or get gunked up with the saturated fatty acids. So, you know, yet another log in the fire to add to the bonfire, which is literally burning up our preconceptions about diet. The notion that, you know, everybody should be on a low-fat diet, or certainly, okay, you can have plenty of fish fats, polyunsaturated fats are okay, fats from vegetable oil are okay, olive oil instead of saturated fat from meat. Well, according to this study, it makes very little difference whatsoever. Okay, next in this American Journal of Clinical Nutrition is an article about BMI, body mass index. And I recently took the BMI on in a blog that I wrote in the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. You can subscribe to the newsletter at radioprogram@AOL.com. We've also put that blog up on Facebook, and now I'm on Twitter @DrRonaldHoffman is my Twitter handle, @DrRonaldHoffman. So follow me on Twitter or friend me on Facebook or subscribe to the newsletter, which is via radioprogram@AOL.com. Just request the newsletter. And in that blog, I talked about how BMI, which is something, body mass index, something that we've been using traditionally for so many years to categorize whether people are overweight, and also not just overweight, but at risk for death of any type, but particularly due to cardiovascular disease, that this measurement is inadequate. And the problem with this measure is that it is used in many studies. We've spent millions and perhaps tens of millions of dollars doing studies on BMI. We now are using BMI as the basis for fat letters that go back to parents. Their kids are, you know, being measured, and they're being told that your kid is at risk. Also, BMI may be a factor in our new healthcare laws, that people are entitled to an annual wellness exam. They'll be given a report card. They'll be told you're too fat or you're just right, based on an outmoded measure, which is BMI. BMI, by the way, was developed in, oh, this must have been the 1850s, by a Belgian mathematician named Quetelet with a Q. And so it's a very, very old measure. I don't know how this guy came up with such a complicated measure, but it's very hard for an ordinary person to figure out their BMI without what is called a plug-in. You can go to some place on the internet, enter your height and weight, and boom, it'll spit out your BMI. Problem is, BMI is not very accurate for strong, muscular individuals, athletic folks who are in good condition, because let's say you are a running back for the National Football League, and you're 5'10", but you're built like a fire plug, and you weigh 220 pounds, and you can do the 40-yard dash in under 5 seconds. I mean, they're actually guys, that's a pretty standard accomplishment for some of the running backs in the National Football League. They're big, they're built low to the ground. They would be considered obese by the BMI because, you know, figure 5'10", 220 pounds. I'm personally 5'10", I weigh about 170 pounds. And so, you know, it's not a very accurate measure. And it's been suggested that the BMI be replaced with something called the ABSI, which is a new system for figuring in waist circumference, because waist circumference is important. These guys who are the running backs, they got pretty skinny waists. They got big shoulders. They got thunder thighs. They're very heavily muscled, big chests, but generally they're kind of nipped in the waist. And so figuring in waist circumference gives you additional information to tell you whether you're at risk of literally dying, right? All right, so this study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition says cardiometabolic risk factors in obesity. Does it matter whether BMI or waist circumference is the index of obesity? And this is actually a defense of the BMI, because what they're saying here is that BMI is a pretty good predictor of waist circumference, and waist circumference is one of the best determinants of whether you have insulin resistance, which is a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, even cancer. And it's certainly one of the ways where, well, that's how we determine whether people are fat. You know, it's like, are you fat? Well, you know, what's your belt size? What they found was that most individuals with an abnormal BMI also have abnormal waist circumference. Now, the problem is there are some outliers. What they found is that probably something along the lines of 20% of people are not at particular high risk of cardiovascular disease, even if they're considered overweight or obese, by the body mass index. And the reason for that is what's called the obesity paradox. There are some individuals who are fat and fit, and especially as you get older, especially you get in, you know, past 70 or so, individuals who are chunky, their BMI is excessive, they actually may do better than individuals with what is called a normal BMI, certainly better than people who have a low BMI, because a low BMI might be a sign of frailty. But anyway, in this study, they're saying, eh, don't get too hopped up about the BMI. The BMI is okay. I'm not a big fan of the BMI. I think we should use the ABSI, plug ABSI into your browser, into Google or Yahoo, whatever you use, and find the ABSI tables that you can use with your height, your weight, and your waist circumference. And that'll give you an even better estimation of whether you're near optimal bodily proportions. At the Hoffman Center, we use a body composition analysis, which measures fat percentage. It's measured electronically through a painless electrical current that is run through your body. And that's a very, very accurate way of determining what percentage fat you are. For women, you should be less than one-third body fat. Obviously, women have curves, more fat than men. Men should be less than one-quarter body fat. Last time I checked, about 12% body fat. That's pretty good, considered more along the lines of a healthy athlete. Do antioxidant levels matter when it comes to cataracts? Should you be taking antioxidants to prevent cataracts? Well, certainly there's evidence that in macular degeneration, antioxidants are beneficial. Zinc was the first one that was discovered. Then it was learned that taking other antioxidants may support the role of zinc, so that formulas which are designed to prevent macular degeneration contain zinc, selenium, and acetylcysteine, and exceptional antioxidants like resveratrol or curcumin or green tea. Proanthocyanidins from berries are helpful for vision. And then it was found that DHA from fish oil is also beneficial for protecting the retina from macular degeneration. And most recently, it was discovered that higher levels of folic acid, B12 and B6, help to prevent high homocysteine, which is now implicated in macular degeneration. So the story is still being worked out in terms of macular degeneration. But when it comes to cataracts, less clear. There are some studies that show that there are protective effects of certain nutrients. And here's a study, association of blood antioxidants and vitamins with risk of age-related cataract. And what they discovered is that blood levels of certain antioxidants are protective. The higher the blood level, the more protection you have against cataract. And they looked at a wide variety of antioxidant nutrients. They looked at the carotenoids, alpha-carotene, beta-carotene, lutein, zeaxanthin. Those specifically are helpful for macular generation. Lycopene, beta-cryptoxanthin, vitamin C, vitamin E, and vitamin A, which some people consider to be, at least in part, an antioxidant. And what they discovered was that, indeed, there was protection provided by higher levels of these antioxidants in the blood, protecting against cataract. Now, they hasten to add, because, you know, this is characteristic of a lot of nutrition literature, particularly in a conservative medical journal like the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they're not ready to jump to the conclusion that taking antioxidant or vitamin supplements could prevent cataracts. But they, in a muted way, say the role of antioxidant or vitamin supplement intake in preventing cataracts should be further investigated in what are called interventional studies, which means do an experiment, have a large population group take these antioxidants over a long period of time compared to placebo, and then we can have the word on whether vitamins and supplements really do protect against cataracts. I'm saying pretty strong evidence that that is the case. So get your antioxidants from foods, but also consider an insurance policy with supplements of antioxidants if you want to protect your vision. This study is particularly cool. Again, in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, does your brain light up when you see a milkshake or a piece of chocolate cheesecake? Well, if you think it does, you may actually be right. This, according to the latest research, they use what's called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. You've heard of MRIs. Well, MRIs look at solid structures within the brain and within the body. A functional MRI looks at parts of the body that light up with metabolic activity or blood flow when that part of the body is engaged. And there's certain parts of the brain that are associated with reward. That's what lights up when somebody takes a hit on a cigarette or snorts a line of coke or shoots up heroin or does any of a number of things that are highly addictive. The part of the brain that is associated with that has been well characterized. It's called the nucleus accumbens, and it's been known to light up on functional MRI when people take addictive substances. So what they did in this study is they did functional MRIs on people who were either fed a low glycemic index food. The test meal was prepared to deliver the sugar at a very low rate in a low glycemic index food. And then there was a supercharged high glycemic index sugary snack. And what they discovered, not surprisingly, is that the high GI meal would light up the brain, in particular, brain regions involved in eating behavior, reward, and addiction. Okay? They also looked at blood sugar levels, insulin, and the subjective report of hunger. And, you know, we kind of do this test. We do a glucose tolerance test. We don't do a functional MRI during the glucose tolerance test, but we feed patients sugar. We measure their insulin levels. We see how they feel. We also look at blood sugar. And what they found in the study was precisely what we see when we give an give a glucose tolerance test to one of our patients at the Hoffman Center. Blood sugars will spike. They'll go up. Patients will feel kind of satisfied and get a little glassy-eyed and relaxed. And then 2 or 3 hours later, they'll become sweaty, agitated, very hungry, and hyper. As the blood sugar plummets, that's a hypoglycemic reaction. And this is precisely what they found. That's no big deal. But what they also found through use of the functional MRI is that the brain lit up. And it lit up very, very dramatically with the high glycemic index food. Now, what's interesting about this study is that, you know, the tobacco industry initially said, you know, cigarettes are not addictive. Well, that's, you know, everybody knows cigarettes are highly addictive, but they tried to make the case that cigarettes really aren't highly addictive, because if they admitted that, they would be in the business of selling something highly addictive that was harmful to a vulnerable populace. And that would be a source of trouble and liability for the tobacco industry. Well, the food industry is confronting something very similar. We now have many studies that show that sugar is a major cause of obesity. And we also have studies like this that suggest that sugar is highly addictive. And we now are studying the physiology, the precise mechanism by which sugar gets people hooked. And once you've established the science, then the lawyers can get a hold of the science and they can say to the people in the food industry, hey, you guys are pushers. You're like the guy who hangs out on the street corner and says, hey, you want to try a little sample bag of heroin? This one's for free. And if you like it, you can come back and get some more. Well, you can imagine what could happen if it hadn't been scientifically established that certain foods are highly addictive, very harmful, and that the food industry is pandering to people's addictions. All right? So get ready for a whole raft of lawsuits, government regulation based on this emerging science. And, you know, I don't think you need a rocket science to know that these foods can get you hooked, because there's a lot of mechanisms. And, you know, we can also, in an editorial in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they say, why just look at functional MRI? Look at levels of dopamine in the bloodstream. Dopamine is, or in the brain, dopamine is a brain neurotransmitter, which is very much associated with reward and craving and addiction. And, for example, individuals who go to Las Vegas and sit at slot machines and endlessly play the slots, they're feeding the dopamine circuits in their brain. And that is a very similar thing that happens when people, you know, go for junk food snacks or have that irresistible craving that makes them gravitate towards the wrong foods. You know, it's kind of all boils down to it's not your fault, you're fat. Because there are folks out there who are very, very, very willing to exploit your vulnerable physiology and brain chemistry to their advantage, increasing their profits. Okay, this article from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition should have huge impact. Nobody is discussing it. But the headline here is low vitamin D concentration exacerbates adult brain dysfunction. We know that vitamin D is helpful for a myriad of things. I mean, first it was said, oh, it's good for your bones. But we know that it's beneficial for your heart. It's helpful against autoimmune disease. and so on and so on, cancer, in a myriad of conditions, vitamin D can make a difference. And now we have evidence from a new study that vitamin D can help to reduce the intensity or the debilitation associated with Parkinson's disease. In this study, it's a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial of vitamin D supplementation in Parkinson's disease. And the conclusion of the study is that vitamin D supplementation may stabilize Parkinson's disease for at least a short period, and it can be used safely at relatively high doses. In this particular study, let's see if we can get the exact amount of vitamin D that was used. They gave patients, they gave patients vitamin D, vitamin D3. They gave a relatively modest amount of vitamin D to these patients. These patients received 1,000 international units of vitamin D in this particular study. They started out with a vitamin D level of 22, which is considered okay, but it's low. And they were brought up to a vitamin D level of 41.7, which is, that's what I consider at the very least level that people should achieve in order to optimize their health. So that made a difference in these Parkinson's disease patients. And there's an editorial in the American Journal of Nutrition that talks about a wide variety of brain disorders where vitamin D may make a difference. It turns out that there are lots of vitamin D receptors in areas of the brain which process dopamine, such as the substantia nigra. The substantia nigra that's the part of the brain that is most effective in Parkinson's disease. So they also have found that vitamin D may have what is called a neuroprotective effect. It has been shown that pretreatment with vitamin D helps to reduce the effect of toxic chemicals that can cause Parkinson's disease. It's suspected that exposure to toxic chemicals may cause Parkinson's disease. There are some people who use drugs and develop Parkinson's disease. Farmers who handle pesticides and herbicides have a greater susceptibility to Parkinson's disease. Certain industrial workers who are exposed to chemicals, and of course all of us are exposed to chemicals in this environment, pretreatment with vitamin D may attenuate the adverse effects of these chemicals. Also, and this is really important, they have a model for studying strokes in, I guess it's a rat model. They study strokes by, unfortunately, inducing strokes in experimental animals. They tie off a major artery that leads to the brain, the carotid artery, and the animal develops a stroke, and then that's how they do stroke research. But when they give the animals vitamin D deficient diets before administering the stroke lesion that cuts off circulation of the brain, the ones who were vitamin D deficient had significantly greater brain damage and worse functional impairments than those rodents who were fed rat chow or mouse chow that was fortified with vitamin D. So that's pretty cool. They also say that vitamin D deficiency may alter brain development. There's evidence that it may contribute, not directly cause, but it may be something that potentiates neurodevelopmental disorders such as schizophrenia. There's also evidence that vitamin D may play a protective role against autism. And so there's a lot of information now coming out on vitamin D's potential protective role on the brain. Good stuff. How are you liking this? I find this quite fascinating to cull through the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, some of these back issues, and looking for articles of relevance, because there's a lot in happening in the world of nutritional science that brings us practical lessons for what we should be eating and what supplements we should be taking. So let's take a look at yet another. The question is, can fish oil make you smarter? Well, we know that in infants, that consumption of something called DHA, which is present in breast milk, mother's breast milk, and until recently was not allowed to be put in the infant formula in the United States. Many of the countries of the developed world, Europe, Canada, they were out in front of us in terms of fortifying formulas for infants with DHA, because it was missing DHA, and DHA is a very, very important nutrient, especially for brain function in kids. So finally, we got on board with it a few years back, and now there's DHA in U.S. infant formula. And so we know that DHA may play a role for infant development. Also, it's important for mom to have adequate levels of DHA because she transmits the DHA via the placenta and also later through breast milk. So it's important to get adequate amounts of omega-3 fatty acids. Doxyhexaenoic acid is the companion long-chain fatty acid to EPA, which is found in fish oil. We also know that DHA may play a role at the end of life or in later years to help stave off cognitive decline, Alzheimer's disease. It certainly helps to preserve eye function. So what about just regular adults? Regular adults, individuals in the middle of life. And this has particular implications for a lot of people, right? You want to be smarter? Well, we could all use a few extra IQ points these days. This study was done in New Zealand. 228 adults aged 18 to 45 were randomly assigned to receive either 1.2 grams of DHA or a placebo pill daily for 6 months. And they tested their brain function. And in particular, they were looking at memory and reaction times in healthy young adults, that is 18 to 45. And to begin with, their diets were low in DHA. So you're probably not going to see much of an effect if you're already consuming lots of DHA from oily fish. But they already picked adults who weren't getting much in the way of omega-3 fatty acids. And what they found was that there was a significant improvement in their memory and in reaction times. And they point out that these memory-related cognitive domains are the building blocks of more complex cognitive functions or behaviors that are common in everyday life. Where did I put my keys? How do I react to this traffic condition? Reaction time is very important. It's important in sports and in athletics, and it helps us function in our day-to-day lives. So their conclusion is, thus, young, healthy adults may cognitively benefit from an increased consumption of DHA. Not to say that EPA isn't important. We're going to be doing some podcasts in the near future. We're going to talk to an individual who has done research on the brain effects of omega-3 fatty acids and their potential for reducing violence. Violence being, a form of brain disorder that may be worsened by lack of essential fatty acids. That'll be Stuart Tomk coming up, TOMC, coming up next week, I believe. Finally, let's close the book on the Journal of the American American Journal of Clinical Nutrition to take a look at this news story, it's some food for thought. You know the expression, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs? Well, that saying has been attributed to Joseph Stalin, one of the world's most notorious dictators. And if you look at his governing style, he certainly broke some eggs. That statement has been widely interpreted as meaning that in order to achieve something important, it is inevitable and necessary that something be destroyed. And certainly vast parts of the Soviet Union and incredible numbers of people were destroyed in an effort to get to whatever utopian goal Joseph Stalin envisioned for the Russian people. But so the saying is, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Well, another really big shot person is trying to bypass that particular proposition. He's trying to make an omelet without breaking some eggs. And that individual would be Bill Gates. You know, Bill Gates made billions with Microsoft, and now he's on a mission to spend his money, basically, and improve the world. And he's got a vision of how that could be. A radical artificial egg backed by Bill Gates and one of his associates, PayPal billionaire Peter Thiel. So every time you buy something via PayPal, this guy gets a little 1 cent commission. He's got billions of dollars. And these guys, they're looking for investment opportunities, and they found something that they really like. A radical artificial egg, which will go on sale in U.S. supermarkets for the first time this month. It's a product made by Hampton Creek. It's called Beyond Egg, and they have a mayonnaise that is not made with eggs. Josh Tetrick, the firm's founder, says, we want to take animals completely out of the equation. The artificial eggs are a special blend of plants, including peas and beans. They say that the eggs made of this concoction are indistinguishable from products made with real eggs, and you can even bake chocolate chip cookies. And they're better than eggs. They're even better because they don't have any cholesterol and they don't have any saturated fat. And they say that this is going to be a boon to mankind because we all know, well, wait a minute, earlier in the broadcast I said that saturated fat and cholesterol weren't so bad for you. Well, Bill Gates, in his infinite wisdom, along with the other genius, PayPal billionaire Peter Thiel, think that we can improve on Mother Nature and create low-fat, no-cholesterol eggs that are even cheaper than eggs. And, oh, there's another advantage because eggs contribute to global warming. Did you know that? Is when you grow animals, they poop and they excrete methane. And it's a high-energy process altogether to feed the animals. And they're contributing to global warming. And the seas will rise and swamp us. And we'll all be sweltering in heats and in heat. And there'll be horrible storms and hurricanes that'll make Hurricane Sandy look like a walk in the park if we don't stop these chickens from pooping and create artificial eggs. That's what this proposition is all about. Their stated goal is what we want to do eventually. By the way, this is always international. They're always working in around the globe. This is a global internationalist effort. What we want to do eventually is find a way to work with farmers in the developing world to enable them to have new cash crops that can be used. Then we'd become the kind of company to be feared by the bad guys in the industry, presumably those guys who are making that high cholesterol, saturated fat laden, old-fashioned egg, which gunks up your arteries, and the chickens are polluting the environment and destroying the planet. So look for Beyond Eggs. They're going to hit your supermarket shelves soon. If they're not there already, ask for them. But in my opinion, this is not a great idea because it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. Eggs, perfectly safe. There's an article in one of my American Journal of Clinical Nutrition's that I haven't yet shared with you. But the article is all about how yet another study showing that eggs have no deleterious effects in terms of cardiovascular disease. And in fact, eggs are really important. Cholesterol, dietary cholesterol is important. Choline that is present in eggs is essential for brain function, nervous system function, for the liver. And eggs are a particularly rich source of lutein, which is important for vision. And people who are told to go on statins and avoid eggs because of the cholesterol, the statins may interfere with the absorption of the requisite nutrients. Some of these medications actually may interfere with fat-soluble nutrients. And lutein is fat-soluble. And also, what are you going to do if you've eliminated the major source of lutein in your diet, which is eggs? Your cholesterol may come down, but you also may be more susceptible to macular degeneration. So, you know, once again, these guys, you know, they're great philanthropists, and they're out to save the world, and they've got a vision of how they can do it. But as usual, these utopian plans often go awry when it comes to improving the lot of mankind. I'll stick to my eggs, thank you very much. And I've got a dozen eggs sitting in the refrigerator right now. Hopefully that'll last me through the week. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. Make sure you follow us on Facebook, now on Twitter. Dr. Ronald Hoffman is my Twitter handle. Subscribe to the Intelligent Medicine newsletter, radio program at AOL.com. Drop us a line. Ask to be put on the newsletter mailing list. We'll send it to you. We won't use your information to sell or to put you on a bunch of mailing lists for erectile dysfunction supplements. And you'll gain a lot of useful information. And, oh, by the way, go to drhoffman.com. This month we will be completely revamping our website. I think you'll be pleased. And check out our store for products that will enhance your health and extend your longevity. And we got great product descriptions and great prices at the store at drhoffman.com. Help support the Intelligent Medicine podcast with your patronage. We appreciate very much your downloading these podcasts and your faithful listenership. We also have a weekly radio program. It's Health Talk on the WR Radio Network, WR710.com for podcasts and podcasts of Intelligent Medicine, of course. Well, you know because you're already listening via iTunes or at drhoffman.com. And a very happy new year to many of our listeners who are celebrating the Jewish New Year. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.